Monday, and welcome to Detroit Today on 101.9 WDET. I'm Stephen Henderson, and as always, thanks for tuning in. One of the great and at the same time confounding things about our lives these days is the extent to which data fills our lives. We've got this immense computational power in our pockets and often in the palms of our hands. And that means we have a lot more information at our disposal than we did just 5 or 10 years ago. And that means we're subject to millions of perspectives about our lives, about our city, about our country. And they're all right there, ready for us to digest. Americans also have more access to public polling data than ever before. It's part of this huge information flow that mostly comes through our phones and our computers. We now have knowledge about how our fellow citizens feel about all kinds of things: higher prices, the reality of climate change, their support for the sitting president or the Congress. And of course, with the midterms just a week away, we are inundated right now with polling data. I gotta say, as a member of the public and as a journalist, sometimes it feels hard to properly interpret polling data. There are lots of different kinds of polls, of course, and each of them kind of tells us something different about the race or the issue that they're asking about. There are a lot more projections, a lot more money chasing after how the public feels on a range of issues. And that makes it hard to know how much stock to put into so many collective responses to things. How much can we trust one poll or the other, or the entire polling institution itself? Go back to 2016, and I think a lot of people were especially turned off by polls, after seeing so many polls that said that Democratic presidential nominee Hillary Clinton was going to win. Lots of people decided after that election, when she didn't win, that they were never going to look at polls again. And look, I got to sympathize with that feeling. There was a lot of frustration around our politics at that point as well. The disappointment that people felt about the election, I think, helped cast polls in a really dark light. But pause for a second and think if that makes sense. Don't we really need to understand what's going on in the various campaigns? And what can we really understand from polling? That's the real question. What should we expect to know from looking at a poll? And how do we accurately read polls, especially when there are so many different kinds of polls in our politics? Also, in a democracy, are public opinion polls not some of the most important pieces of information we could possibly know, whether you're a politician, whether you're a citizen, or a journalist? This is the kind of case that data journalist and U.S. correspondent for The Economist, G. Elliot Morris, makes. He analyzes polls all the time in his work. And in his new book, Strength in Numbers, he takes a step back to explore the history of polling, how it works, and why ultimately he thinks it's a really important tool for democracies to function and to flourish. I'm really pleased to welcome Elliot here to discuss his book, to explain polling, and to make the case for this tool that makes the American public's opinions the center of our attention during campaign season. Elliot, welcome to Detroit Today.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me here. And what a great introduction for the book. You're really setting up, I think, a good conversation about the polls.
Oh, thank you. I'm actually really excited about this, as, of course, a journalist like yourself who is constantly taking in polling data and trying to make sense of it. So let's start here. Let's just explain political polling, how it works, and explain the broad spectrum of political polling. I think that's one of the things that eludes so many people and makes them you know, confused and angry sometimes because they don't really understand that there are lots of different kinds of polls and they're all measuring different things.
Yeah, well, look, you started off at a big data distinction, a bit paradoxically, you're setting up a paradox, I think. We have all this data around us, health data, consumer behavior data. We have ads targeted to us online based on our internet browsing data. So shouldn't polling data also have a reliable indicator, not about us as individuals, but us in aggregate? Should this hypothetical survey of 1,000 Americans, shouldn't it be really accurate? We live in this age of computers and smartphones, right? So that, I think, is what sets up some pretty impossible expectations for the pollsters, as recent elections have shown. And it's not necessarily, I don't think, sort of exclusive to the polling industry that they would miss this expectation. In fact, I think it's sort of a miscalibration of the entire big data conversation. And polls are not big data, actually, as much as we would like to think they are, as much as, you know, I work on some of the back ends of polling. So as much as we use data and statistics and machine learning to get polls to match up with what we think is for reality. But at the end of the day, it's a survey of a couple hundred or maybe 1,000 people if a pollster has a lot of money. And those people answering the phone when a pollster calls or clicking on a survey online, let's say there are 1,000 of them, for example's sake, they might not be totally representative of the public of, say, the United States or maybe just Michigan. Racially, they might be too white. Mm-hmm. Maybe they're too upper class. Maybe they have too high of incomes or they're too educated or something like this. And so pollsters have to do a lot of basic statistical wizardry to get those numbers, those population benchmarks to match up with the population so that they can say, we have, you know, a representative survey based off of, you know, based on these demographic variables. Therefore, we think that we are drawing good inferences on the other things we care about politics, about life, about culture. And that's not big data. That is small data. And that's a really tough problem for pollsters to solve. And that's true in what pollsters call issue polling, which is just questions about issues, about policies, about their life, like I'm saying. It's even truer on elections when people are expecting, readers like you and me even sometimes, expecting just laser-like predictive accuracy from mm-hmm. these polls, that this, you know, Governor Whitmer plus one or two is going to be right on average from these polls. But as recent elections, I think, have hopefully started maybe to nail into people's heads. This is not, you know, the polls do not offer that level of precision because of all this other guesswork, because of all these other corrections that have to go on under the hood.
Would it be fair to say that even as we become more sophisticated in our use of data to do lots of different things, and here I'm thinking specifically about the redistricting process, which uses an incredible array of data to determine how political boundaries should be drawn, and I mean it's so specific in some cases that they can talk about which houses on which blocks should be in which districts in order to get a certain outcome. That at the same time, polling, as you point out, is experiencing something of a lapse in the benefits from all of that incredible power that we're able to be more specific in other arenas, but in the polling arena, it's we're still struggling, I guess, to make sense of what polls actually tell us and how accurate they are.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, the advantage of some of these redistricting simulations is that they have the actual numbers on actual behavior from people.
Voting.
They know voting. They're not their votes, but whether or not they voted. And they can use polling data and other data, right, to come up with pretty good models about how everyone in every single house in America voted in the last election. And on average, that sort of thing is useful in drawing districts. But I should say maybe those models also wouldn't provide the sort of laser-like predictive accuracy that we come to expect from the polls. I do think it's an expectations game. And the reason that polls will never be able to meet those expectations, I don't think they ever have, even in the sort of 2008 and 2012 era where the polls were, you know, allegedly calling 50 states correctly in every election, right? Mm-hmm. Even in that era, the polls suffered from the same fundamental problem that they do today, and that is you cannot talk to a representative sample of Americans if you just call 1,000 of them, because response rates are pretty low, because the type of people who will talk to you about politics for 20 or 30 minutes are weirdos like you and me, statistically speaking. And you can't necessarily remove all of the error that that brings into the process just by saying, you know, by fiat, oh, this poll needs to have, you know, 11% black voters, so we'll just force the percentages to add up to 11. And that's a fundamental problem with polling, that the people you talk to might not be representative of the people you don't. And pollsters can get around that problem to a certain degree of accuracy. They cannot get around that problem to like a decimal point degree of accuracy, which is, in this era of prediction and big data, what we want from them. They'll just never be able to do that.
Yeah, yeah. I'm talking with G. Elliot Morris. He is a data journalist and the U.S. correspondent for The Economist. He's also the author of Strength in Numbers, How Polls Work and Why We Need Them. We're talking just 8 days before Election Day 2022 about the value of polls, how they work, why Elliot thinks they're good and an important part of the political process, and also where we're headed with polling. We want to hear from you as well during the conversation call, and tell us how much you trust polls. How much stock do you put in polls, especially this time of year when we're about to go into the ballot box and make a bunch of important decisions here in Southeast Michigan and across the state and all across the country? Let me know. Are you somebody who does pay attention to polling and kind of keeps up with it? Or are you somebody who is kind of trying to block that out because you feel like it's noise, that that maybe it's not accurate and maybe it's intended to sway you illegitimately to make a certain kind of decision? Also, if you have any questions about polling, I know lots of folks are sometimes confused about how polls work, how to know how accurate they are. Elliot Morris is absolutely the person to ask about those things. 313-577-1019 is the number here on the phones. That's 313-577-1019. You can also go to Twitter and hashtag Detroit Today, and we'll work you into the conversation. Before we get to our listeners, I want to just quickly go over some of the tips that you would have for people trying to read polls. I mean, you know, percentages, the gaps in percentages, also the sort of temporal value of polls is one of the things I'm really interested in. That if I ask people on October 15th what they're likely to do, how predictive is that of what they're going to do on November 8th? You know, this kind of idea of a snapshot versus a moving kind of interest that people might have. But talk about how to read polls intelligently, especially this time of year.
Yeah, so that's a good place to start, I think, on the snapshot rule. And what pollsters will tell you is that they're not coming up with predictions of how people will vote on election day, they have a snapshot in time, a measurement on that day of how people feel. And we call it a measurement. Really, I think scientifically we should call it an estimate because of all of this error we were talking about earlier. And so that's the first point, that whatever is estimated by a pollster on whichever day, let's say October, what is today, the 31st, mm-hmm. could change in the next 8 days before an election, for example. The second, polls have a lot of noise, and so therefore you should look at as many as possible instead of just a single poll. And that's why at The Economist, that's why at The Times and 538, we have polling averages. The idea here is if you have, say, 10 individual polls, that the error, that the noise in any given poll could be canceled out by a body of other polls and give you a more reliable reading. So say for example, actually, I have the polls for Michigan's governor race up right now on my computer, and it says, you know, CNN recently have a poll that has Governor Whitmer up 14 percentage points. Mm-hmm. But then there's another poll that has her up only 1 percentage point over the Republican challenger, Dixon. What do you make of that? Well, maybe you want to go through the poll and interrogate all the assumptions and all the numbers and decide which one you think is best. But really, the best empirical, historically, decision here is to average them together. So plus 1 and plus 14 become plus 7. And that's your estimate. And so that's the second tip, is to average as many polls together as possible. Like we were saying earlier, that's not going to give you a final laser-like prediction of a horse race election, but it will give you a better idea than relying on one single poll, mm-hmm. because you don't have to suffer from the noise. But the third point, and this is a bit more wonky, and not necessarily something that's broken through the conversation in the past, is that the uncertainty on this average of polls is even higher than the science of aggregation would imply. The implication being, if you have, say, 1,000 polls in Michigan, if you average them together, you get a perfect prediction. We know that's not true anymore, because if, say, one group in the country isn't responding to polls from CNN and FSRS, they might also not be responding to polls from, say, the New York Times or, you know, Detroit Free Press or something. And that means that there's a chance for systematic error or bias across polling houses. Mm-hmm. So the third tip here is to sort of imagine in your head around this average that you see on 538, or maybe you're conducting it yourself because you're like a super polling dork like me, that estimate has a margin of error probably of 6 or 7 percentage points on election day, and even more before that, because of this chance that the types of people talking to one pollster aren't talking to other pollsters. So that's what I would tell people. Look at the average. Consider polling bias, not just polling error, and that the election could bear out different results from the poll simply because people change their mind after the poll is taken.
Yeah. Okay, we're going to take
for the horse race.
Yeah, right. Okay, we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to continue this conversation with Elliot Morris of The Economist, author of Strength in Numbers, and we will get going with you on the phones and on social media. Simon in Madison Heights, Frank in Livonia, Karen in Macomb County, you'll be up first if you want to join them. 313-577-1019 is the number here on the phones. That's 313-577-1019. You can also go to Twitter and hashtag Detroit Today, and we'll work you into the conversation. We'll be right back with more Detroit Today. This is Detroit Today on 101.9 WDET. I'm Stephen Henderson, and as always, thanks for tuning in. Our guest is G. Elliot Morris. He's a data journalist and U.S. correspondent for The Economist. is the author of a book called Strength in Numbers, How Polls Work and Why We Need Them. We're talking about polling with just 8 days to go in the 2022 campaign season. There are polls everywhere about every race that we will make a decision on in 8 days. What do you make of all of that information? Are you somebody who tracks the polls pretty closely and uses them to understand what's happening or maybe help you make decisions on election day? Or are you somebody who just kind of screens all of that out? Maybe you don't have a lot of faith in polls or what they are telling us. Maybe you're annoyed by the volume of data about elections. How many polls do we need about the governor's race, for instance? As always, the number here on the phones is 313-577-1019. That's 313-577-1019. You can also join us through Twitter by hashtagging Detroit Today, and we can work your comments into the conversation. Let's begin today with Simon in Madison Heights. Simon, welcome to the show.
Hey, happy Halloween.
Hey, happy Halloween to you too.
So I graduated college about 12 years ago from Grand Valley. And my first job, just getting out of college, it was just some stupid hiring fair type of thing, you know, was at a call center. It was a market research firm that mostly dealt with health insurance and radio stations.
Mm-hmm.
And I found out that my boss was extremely racist, or at least just the polling system can seem that way. Because one day, you know, you're talking to a majority people of color city, like you're calling Memphis, and you can only talk to white people. And every white person just hangs up on you and, like, calls you some kind of epithet or, like, you know, gets really, really angry. And then I talked to one poor mixed race person, and me being a very naive farm boy from northern Michigan, I was like, excuse me, well, which race is? And he's like, you don't know what a mixed kid is? And I'm like, hey, I'm sorry, like, which I have to, like, answer this question. And they're like, well, why are you calling me? And I'm like, oh, man, you're white today. You know what I mean? Like, I'm talking to the white half. And he's like, that's pretty messed up, you know. But he said effed up. And I was like, hey, it's just, if I get sent home without being paid for lunch and I only get a half day because I don't finish one survey today, like, just hold the line, buddy. And, like, he was like, oh.
So, Simon, like, yeah. Simon, I want to be clear. I understand what you're saying was happening. You were calling white respondents, and or it was designed to only have you talk with white respondents?
Yeah, yeah. And, well, it was a mixed-race kid who was black and white, and mm-hmm. I was like, okay, well, which race do you want to identify with? And first he said black, and I was like, it'll lock me out of the survey if you say that.
That's interesting.
And I was like, this is profound. And I didn't even know I was being racist all day long for 40 hours a week. You know what I mean?
Simon, I'm really glad you called and shared that experience. I mean, I don't get a chance to talk to lots of people who work on that end of polling. Elliot, I wonder what you make of what he's describing here.
Yeah, that's really fascinating. I love talking to people or hearing from people from their experience conducting surveys or even being surveyed,
mm-hmm.
because it differs so significantly from the mathematics here. I mean, what it reminds me of in the book is there's an episode in early polling when it's being conducted door to door. You know, with people with clipboards, like your traditional idea of a 1950s mm-hmm. pollster, and they, some wider employees from Elmo Roper's polling operation. He's one of those sort of big three original pollsters, along with George Gallup and Archibald Crossley. And some mm-hmm. of them employees said they didn't feel safe walking in Harlem, the black part of, Manhattan at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And so they didn't do interviews there. And those sort of the opinions that WASP of Manhattan were not accounted for most of the time by Elmo Roper's polls. And similarly, George Gallup, in devising a survey that would be maximally predictive of election results, almost excluded black Southerners from his survey because he said, well, they can't vote if I'm trying to figure out who's going to win the election, if there's just not utility in talking to them. And so their voices also were excluded from his polls, at least when he was doing them, of the likely electorate. And I mean, right? I mean, this is kind of a reminder that these surveys are tools of us as humans. They're going to come with our biases as people as well. I mean, mathematically in this case, right, I don't exactly know. Maybe this market researcher was trying to figure out like what things that they could sell to white people in Memphis in particular. I can't speak to their exact goals. But these days I would say that like that problem, that specific problem has been fixed because we have government data on mixed race is a government category now.
Uh-huh.
But that wasn't always the case. I mean, the census essentially, just by way of tangent, invented the Hispanic category as well. And that's why it gets asked to people. We would have maybe the broader point here is like we have the vocabulary to express ourselves as a public that the pollsters give us. And that is an incredibly powerful tool on the part of the pollsters. It can be wielded for good, and it can also be abused.
Yeah, yeah. Simon, I really appreciate the call, and I love that you've had some experience actually trying to conduct polls. Let's go to Frank in Livonia next. Frank, welcome to the show.
Hey, good morning. I'll have to say I don't rely on polls at all. I shut all that information out. The only ones that I'm really interested in are on, you know, Wednesday morning. Well, it, you know, and it might take longer, but, you know, after the polls closed and the results are in, you know, that's based on historical data. You know, a lot of the stuff that they've done for, like, Proposal 2. You know, I think that one of the things that drives a lot of this polling thing is journalists. And this drive for the scoop, be the first one to call it.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I mean, I don't, you know, I mean, I'm listening to your guest, and he's really, his basic point is don't rely on these polls. They're just too close. It's too soft. It's too fluffy of information. If you rely on it, that's on you.
Yeah.
Frank,
I really appreciate that perspective. And I have to say, not just as a journalist, but as a journalist who was part of the staff, part of the leadership at the Detroit Free Press during the 2016 elections, when we called Michigan for Hillary Clinton very early in the evening because the data from our really longtime super trusted pollster told us that there were votes coming in the city of Detroit that had not yet been counted, and that those votes, if you accounted for them and against what was already coming in from out of state, suggested that there was no way that Donald Trump could win the election. I mean, it was one of the most embarrassing mistakes we'd ever made at the Detroit Free Press, and it was about trying to predict, based on a long history of polling, what would happen in terms of the turnout in that election. But I'm also interested in your point about the kind of marriage, I guess, between journalism and polling. You put it a little more critically, I think, but that there is this reliance on each other. That sometimes leads us to irresponsible use, I guess, is probably the best description of polls. Elliot, talk about that relationship and how we as journalists should be more careful when we talk about and make predictions based on the polls.
Yeah, that's a good question. In my capacity at The Economist, I both average polls and create election forecasting models. And those models get a bad rap because, you know, some of them said Hillary Clinton, for example, had a 99% chance to win Michigan, or, you know, even the ones that were maybe more reasonable still were more favorable to her in the national picture in 2016, similar for Joe Biden in 2020. The utility there is twofold. You know, first, journalists are responding to, a genuine interest from the public that wants to know where the public stands before an election, what's likely to happen, you know, what maybe what their neighbors think, or if maybe in a particularly polarized time if they've lost their minds or whatever. and that fuels a drive that journalism responds to. And either that response is going to be the highest quality sort of scientific distillation of the polls, or it's going to be hand-wavy punditry. Mm-hmm. I mean, before we had scientific polls, we had what were called straw polls, and those were, you know, nearly as scientific as the ones today. They were, you know, reporters from newspapers like, you know, the Detroit Free Press and smaller papers across the country sending out one or two reporters to, like, 4th of July parades and military roll calls and asking people, who are you going to vote for? And those are the numbers that got reported on. And those were obviously much less predictive than what we have now. You had betting markets also in the early 1900s that were being reported on in major newspapers. Here's what the betting line is at, like, you know, this fancy Manhattan club for the Wall Street people also making bets on politics, right? And those predictions were worse also. So polls are good in the sense that there's no clear replacement. I mean, there's this old Winston Churchill quote, right, that, like, democracy is the worst way of doing things except for all the other ways of doing things.
Right.
And that, I think, can be said about polls, too. If you're trying to measure something, then, you know, polls aren't going to give you 100% accuracy 100% of the time, but they're going to give you way better accuracy than anything else.
Yeah.
So that's the first point. But I should say, you know, election forecasts get a bad rap because of these previous predictive misfires, but what they're doing under the hood is really important. When we make an election forecast, I'm essentially mathematically doing what I'm doing in this conversation, just relaying to you how much error and bias there could be in the polls, and therefore how much to trust them. Mm. I mean, this message gets a little muddied because we put probabilities on it, and I'm one of the people in the camp that thinks we shouldn't be putting probabilities on it because of this muddying of the information that we're trying to get across to you. But, you know, if I say, well, Whitmer's +7 in the polls today, but the worst errors in Michigan over the past decade have been about 7 percentage points on margin, I think that's conveying to you, the caller, something different than me saying, well, Whitmer has a 95% chance to win. And that's really two ways of expressing the same data point, but I think you're getting a much more reliable picture with the former. And so, you know, you're sort of at the mercy of how the election forecasters and the pollsters are choosing to portray information mm-hmm, to you.
Mm-hmm.
But at least in our case, we're trying to do a much better job now of focusing on the uncertainty in terms that people can understand. And so your original sort of opener here was, I don't pay attention to polls at all. Well, I would say don't not pay attention to them at all, but come to them with an acknowledgement of their past failures and an acknowledgement of their sort of fundamental theoretical limitations. Yeah. And maybe think about the polls more broadly, the ones that say, you know, do you want clean drinking water? Do you want, you know, more highway investment? Do you want tax cuts, these sorts of things, rather than the ones about who's going to win the next election.
So one of the other things I think is important to think about is how accurate polls can be in predicting voter behavior at a time when the electorate is as volatile as it is, both volatile in terms of its politics. I mean, all the time I sit and marvel at the fact that this is a country that twice elected Barack Obama and then turned around and twice or at one time elected Donald Trump. I mean, whatever you think of either of those candidates, I mean, the swing there is really profound. But also in terms of turnout, it's harder and harder, I think, to predict who will show up on election day. And of course, predicting that is key to predicting what those people will do, how those people will vote. I mean, you've got a lot of swirl, I guess, in all of that. That seems like it makes the models that you use in polling less reliable than they would be when things are more static.
Yeah, I mean, the other use for polls here is in figuring out why those voters changed their mind, to your earlier point. Not mm-hmm. just the fact that they did, mm-hmm. but asking them questions that maybe pollsters think tap onto salient political issues, or even asking people to explain themselves in their own words. And again, that's a really incredibly powerful tool that we have no other substitute for in as systematic a fashion as sort of polling provides us access to people. I mean, reporters can do it, but they can't talk to 1,000 people.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, we're going to take another quick break. And when we come back, we'll continue this conversation with Elliot Morris and with you, Karen in Macomb County, Phyllis and Warren. We'll get to you next. If you want to join them on the phones, 313-577-1019 is the number. That's 313-577-1019. You can also go to Twitter and hashtag Detroit Today. That's an easy way for us to work you into the conversation as well. We'll be right back with more Detroit Today. You're listening to Detroit Today on 101.9 WDET. I'm Stephen Henderson, and as always, thanks for tuning in. We're talking with G. Elliot Morris. He is a data journalist and U.S. correspondent for The Economist. He's the author of a book called Strength in Numbers, How Polls Work and Why We Need Them. I want to hear from you during the conversation as well. 8 days out, how much are you paying attention to the polls that say who will be our next governor, or what will happen with the 3 statewide referenda that are on the ballot? Does this calculate into your decision making? Does this annoy you or distract you in a way that you don't appreciate? And are you somebody who tries to stay away from polling and polling data? I want to hear how you take all of this in and how you make sense of it before we go vote next week. 313-577-1019 is the number here on the phones. That's 313-577-1019. You can also go to Twitter and hashtag Detroit Today, and we'll work you into the conversation. Before we get back to our listeners, Elliot, I want to talk a little about the idea of life without polling and what is the value, I guess, of us having this massive sort of apparatus to be able to tell what people think, not just in the political sphere, but well beyond. I know you're an advocate for the idea of polling. Tell me why.
Well, I think the way to start out is in that political hypothetical, and then maybe moving a little broader. So, you know, imagine a past decade in American politics where the outcomes from the government, where the outputs from Congress and the presidency were all you knew about what Americans wanted from their government. You wouldn't, for example, have knowledge that 80% of people favor universal background checks for gun purchases, mm-hmm. that maybe 55 or 60% favor some sort of universal healthcare coverage from the government, whether or not, you know, setting aside if that includes getting rid of private healthcare, which is less popular. And you wouldn't know, you know, other sort of less contentious information on less contentious topics like on infrastructure funding or that sort of thing, because the policy will of Americans as expressed by the government is so much different than what the will is as expressed by the people in their numerical sum, the number of them, their raw numbers. And I, you know, that sounds basic. We're talking about 2 or 3 policies, but is actually a pretty profound difference when you're talking about what sort of the people are getting out of their sort of social contract with each other.
Mm-hmm.
And so those are pretty large political differences, and they come from the fact that, you know, the electoral institutions in America don't assign winners to a popular vote majority in the presidency or in the Senate or even, you know, even really in the House. And they can distort the will of the people. So polls in that sense are giving us something really profound and the tool that people can use when advocating on their behalf to those legislators who don't always represent them. I mean, it's just one more example. Imagine what your conception of abortion attitudes in America today would be now that Roe v. Wade doesn't exist versus what we know from the polls, which is that 60% of people favor sort of a Roe v. Wade-like legislation.
Mm.
But abstracting a little bit from there, right, I mean, the polls, what they're doing is sort of allowing a community to speak for itself, at least in the language that the pollster gives them. And that act of surveying a people establishes that there is a people to be surveyed.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, that is a democratic process. It's a sort of microcosm of the larger democratic process that sort of purports to happen in America. There's this great quote from former president of the American Political Science Association, where he says that surveys are the ultimate democratic process because they give everyone an equal chance of participating. You know, whether or not that's true for every single poll, we'll set that sort of aside. But the theory here, at least, is that we are giving people a really fair way of participating in democracy, in life, in culture, they wouldn't otherwise have access to by surveying them. And that does have consequences. There's lots of examples in my book of presidents and other politicians responding to those cues, whether or not that's a survey in their congressional district or their state house district, whether or not that, or that's just the approval rating of a president. I mean, these things do tend to sway legislators, at least on the margins. I mean, polls were even maybe responsible for John F. Kennedy's enthusiasm about Medicare in the 1960 election, and that could have had consequences downstream as well. So just imagine what our world would be like if you couldn't say, oh, the, you know, majority of my neighbors think that we should be doing X or Y. That's a very profound thing to do in theory, but also has a lot of real-world consequences that I think tend to be positive. Certainly, they're not always positive.
Mm-hmm.
But it is democratic, lowercase d democratic, in a society that tends, or that is sort of trending in the opposite direction.
Yeah. Again, 313-577-1019 is the number here on the phones. Let's go to Phyllis in Warren. Phyllis, what's on your mind?
I'm curious to know about this polling. Do you really believe that everybody answers honestly? Sometimes I suspect that these polls are simply an easy way out. I don't have to go vote, or I don't have to read a ballot, or I don't have to read up on anything. And I think they're kind of a cop-out sometimes.
Hmm.
I believe they have value for a lot of things, and I see it's interesting to do them, but I can't accept them when it comes to politics. And the second thing is, of course, that I have already voted because I vote absentee.
Mm-hmm.
I do all this studying beforehand. I try to learn as much as I can about every candidate. I am blind, so I have a partner here whom I'm hitting on the head all the time saying, well, what did it say about that? What did it say about that? And my third question is, do you answer when you're polled? Do you give honest answers?
Hmm. Those are great questions, Phyllis. I'll take the last one first and say that I don't answer polls because I'm a journalist, and I feel like there's a conflict there, right? I can't honestly report on something that that I'm a part of, and so that's kind of, maybe that's a cop out, right? I mean, I kind of instinctively say when they call or knock on the door that I can't because I'm a journalist. But Elliot, I wonder what your answer is to that question and the others that Phyllis had.
I guess I'd say I do not empathize with the objection to taking surveys as a journalist. Maybe it's because I report on the polls, mm-hmm. so I want pollsters to have higher response rates and to succeed as an industry. But also, you take the census, right? Even though you report on democracy,
I do take the census. And, that's true.
And it is a poll of sorts. It is a political survey for political means. But I mean, I guess to the broader question here about whether or not people lie to surveys, we know that in isolation there are liars, and there are people who exaggerate the truth or who fib, numbers or what have you. There's also a sort of documented tendency for people to exaggerate a more socially desirable trait, like their height or weight or income.
Mm-hmm.
Research, it's taken a long time for researchers to understand these things, but, now we understand them, so we can control for them when we're analyzing the data. The bigger question is not, are one or two people lying to me, a pollster? It's, are 30% or 40% of my respondents lying to me? Because that would materially change the outcome mm-hmm. of your poll. They're not perfect. The accuracy of a poll relies on the vast majority of people making, being honest about their attitudes, their demographics, not every single one of them.
Yeah. Yeah. Phyllis, great question. I'm glad you called. Let's go next to Brian in Detroit. Brian.
Oh, good morning.
Hey.
I'm a firm believer in that. I really don't like polls for voters because it tends to make people lazy. I think sometimes when they say, oh, my candidate's 100 points ahead or 1 point ahead, they tend to stay home. And then that kind of, I think that's what helped Trump win. Because people thought that Hillary's going to win. The poll said she was going to win. So why spend that half an hour to get out and vote when you can just sit at home?
Yeah.
And when people, but I know politicians need polls to let them know when to work harder and do more for different areas. But as a voter, I really hate polls. Every time I watch the news and they start talking about polling, say this and that, I just change channels to another news channel that's not really talking about polling.
Yeah, Brian, I really appreciate that point, the idea of the effect of polls on things like turnout. Elliot, we've got only about a minute and a half left, but respond to Brian.
There's some research that affirms this. That if you present someone with an election probability, for example, that 99% or whatever Clinton's going to win, then they might not turn out, mm-hmm. or that fewer of them in the hypothetical would turn out, about 10% fewer. There's no real-world evidence for this, I should say, though. All this evidence from social scientists, it's all hypothetical, all experimental online. So it's hard to know how seriously to take it. But I think you raise an sort of important point about how polls get reported on. So this is why I like to emphasize the uncertainty, emphasize not the probabilities, but the historical magnitude of errors or biases in a contest, in a horse race contest. But the other sort of point here goes back to what we were talking about alternatives earlier, right? If we didn't have polls in 2016, if we didn't have, for example, the 538 forecast in 2016 that showed Trump was just a normal polling error away or an above average polling error away mm-hmm. from being president, what we were left with was a bunch of other forecasts that said Clinton had a 98-99% chance to win, and reporters who wrote off Trump completely because they disagreed with him, because he's sort of cantankerous and dangerous in lots of other ways, but just setting that aside, because they disagreed with him, and maybe that was also distorting the picture. Maybe that would have given us an even more distorted picture than what we got from the poll. But it's hard to know. I would say in response, don't base your political behavior, your behavior as a person, on the surveys, on the polling averages, for the exact reason that, yeah. that you bring up. Fair enough.
Okay. Elliot Morris, it was really great to have you here. Congratulations on the book, and thanks for helping to explain polling to our listeners.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah. Okay. That is going to do it for us today. Come back tomorrow. We're going to talk with a government studies professor about how political ads have changed over time and whether they are different and take a more combative posture in today's environment. This is 101.9 WDET-FM, Detroit's NPR station, your connection to news, music, and conversation. We'll talk again tomorrow.